Good morning, everyone. We are scheduled to start our meeting today at 9:30 to receive submissions from the three resource organizations of the state. Assisting us in what we are expected to do, that is establishing a commission of inquiry into the affairs of the Department of Water and Sanitation and its entities. Entities here shall refer to both the water boards and also the TCTA. As expected, we start with our meeting, perhaps that being the only subject for the day. Receiving those submissions from National Treasury, from the Office of the Auditor General, and also from SIU. Part of our quorum talks to a third of our members being present here. A third is your four members of the committee. I don't know how it applies when it comes to joint committees, whether they are treated as one committee. Anyway, that having been the case, therefore, before we even start with our meeting, there are two housekeeping issues we might wish to deal with. One are your are your apologies from Mr. Person, who cannot make it due to illness. He wrote a letter. We're getting a second letter from him. That's the only letter that we have that formally apologizes for not coming or being part of our meeting today. The second housekeeping issue relates to our program. As I mentioned, the National Treasury, Office of the Auditor General, and also SIU are expected to submit on the issues that they are dealing with. That shall be a process that shall assist us in getting to say at the end, these are the package areas that we are going to be focusing at. We have since as part of this whole process, and again, looking at some of the issues that we might wish to look or rather address with one of the entities, an application has since been submitted for us to be able to host a closed session on one of those submission areas. In this instance, this shall talk to the SIU. Before we even start with our meeting, I shall have to put to the committee if the committee has any specific issues on this specific one. In a nutshell, a process has been started requesting or applying for a closed session with the SIU. I put it to the committee for comments. In discussion that I had with the SIU, they are here. The main issue, more than pinje and standing and coming up with all sorts of things that are going to hit the headline. The main issue for us is about getting information from which we are going to use as a source going forward in the inquiries that we're going to get into. Not so much about, you know, headlines and all what it takes. So that's the simple background on the issue. But as I said, I put it up to the committee for us to reflect on that one. Mr. Bratim. Thanks.
Chair, I think it would be useful to have a frank engagement with the SIU, and if it's in committee, it's not ideal, but we do understand the sensitivities of the matter. What does concern me, however, is are we able to use any information given to us by the SIU in that engagement in the subsequent inquiry? So information given to us in committee here in the preparatory phase, is that cloaked with the same secrecy veil, as it were, at a later part in the hearing? And I think maybe we need to get a legal opinion on that. Because, frankly, then, if that is the case, Chair, I'm wondering whether it's worthwhile going into committee. I don't know the rest of my colleagues feel, but if you have the same problem with evidentiary material, then, you know, where are we? We need to get clarity on that, Chair.
Any further comments? Mr. Gallo?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I also wanted to support the proposal that we have a meeting in camera with the SIU, because there are questions that one would like to follow. And the question of secrecy as well, sometimes it becomes a challenge, Honorable Chair. And the other thing one wanted to check in support of what has been said by the last speaker is whether when we are conducting our own investigation as a committee or inquiry, are we going to use the same kind of information? If that is the case, why would, in the first place, we have these parallel processes in this regard? I was just checking, Honorable Chair. Thank you.
Welcome, Ingos. It's quite a very tricky area that we are dealing with. On one hand, advocate, we can go and meet in a closed session. Whether that information can be used going forward, as we have this public inquiry. It's a bit of a tricky one that we'll have to deal with. Part of the discussion that I had with him was to talk to a report or some reports from SIU that go to the president. For now, that is not public information. The second issue talks to the processes that they are currently involved in as part of their investigation. Whether you wouldn't jeopardize or prejudice anyone in that whole exercise. Now these are practical issues that we are dealing with. Again, the issue is very relevant. about whether or not you, it's fine, you can go in camera, but what happens going forward with that information? There is a call for a legal opinion. We might also wish to get to hear any comments from the SIU itself. Okay. Sir? You can just introduce yourself as well, so that everybody gets to know you.
No, thank you. Thank you, Chairperson, or Joint Chairpersons, and members, honorable members of the Joint Committees. Yes, indeed. My name is Advocate Andy Mutibi. I'm the head of Special Investigating Unit. Yes, indeed, I need to confirm what the Chairperson has indicated, that whilst we are willing and able to assist the committee in the process of considering, call it in terms of reference, or how is it that they approach and what is it that they look at, we would like to do that, obviously referring to, number one, some of the experiences that we have gained as part of the past investigations. And we would do so by obviously referring to some of the aspects in those past investigations. And exactly as the Chairperson says, we said we would like to, in the same vein, respect that those aspects are contained in the report that has gone to the President, and it is not public, it hasn't been issued publicly at this stage. So we would like to do that within that that context. Certainly, with regard to the current investigations, and Chair, you'll probably get to see as we present that we really tried to be as informative as possible, without going into those details that would then guard against any prejudice against any party. Part of what we do during the investigations, we invariably come across some of the systemic failures, call it failure of control environment, risk management processes, systems failures, which we then point out. Those are some of the issues that we would also like to share with the committee, just so that when you conceive of the approach and the scope of the inquiry, you can then take that into account. Again, all of those as well, although not as critical as some of the substantive information, systemic recommendations, I suppose, would really not be as prejudicial to any party. Those we could be able to share, but again, within the understanding that they would have been incorporated in the presidential report. So that's the context in which we have made this request, Chairperson and honorable members, that yes, indeed, we would like to assist the committee, but please understand the context and the situation in which we do operate in. Thank you.
Advocate Chung, you want to comment?
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. Good morning, members. Yeah, I would like to comment, sir. The issue of closing a meeting and therefore making the information that's discussed in that meeting classified, so to speak, is really just for Parliament to manage that information. So the rules, and the rule is, if members would like to go and look at it, it's the new NA Rule 189. And that says that the information can be disclosed just with the permission of the committee, as well as if the committee is not sitting with the speaker or the resolution of the House. So the information, in short, can be used, but to disclose it, and from what I'm hearing the head of the SIU indicated, one needs to manage that information, not to prejudice people who is part of the investigation or subject to the investigation, or even to prejudice people who did the investigation, and to just give the proper integrity to the process. But it does not mean that the information cannot be used. So it's, I think in that context, the closed meeting is not, it doesn't hamstring the operations of the committee as such. It's just the manner to manage that information and to release it at the appropriate time. Thank you, Chair. I hope it helped.
Another dilemma, perhaps, that should be spent in the works is that we have the document with us. It has been distributed.
Thanks, Chair. Sorry. I just want to clarify the second part of my inquiry with Advocate Jenkins. So we will take the briefing in camera or in committee, as it is, as it were. That's fine from our point of view. What Advocate Jenkins is saying is when we have that information, we should be just very careful how we manage the release of it. Do I understand that correctly? So we must just be sensitive. And so I suppose at the relevant time, if it is now vital that during the course of our cross-examination or whatever that we use that information, we'll just have to stop and consider that. Is that your understanding, Chair? Are we on the same page there?
To an extent, you know, you're asking yourself as to how will you do that management? How would you manage that? At the risk of prejudicing anyone. It's a very thin line. I'm tempted only, and I repeat, only on the strength of us having this document with us. I'm tempted that we allow the SIU to brief us in this open meeting, having to manage whatever you can manage. In the spirit of Advocate Jenkins, you know, managing whatever we can manage. As to what that means, you know, you should be able to manage that management.
Oh, so I'm being the persistent kid in the classroom.
Yeah.
I think we can do this in committee. It's in the rules. It's not unheard of. Surely it'd be rather better for the joint committees to get a full briefing on what the SIU have. And Advocate Matibi can advise us as he goes along which are the items that are very sensitive and need to be managed. But surely, I'm sure my colleagues...
You mean in a closed session?
Yes, in a closed session, and we have a full disclosure from the SIU what's going on, but it indicates to us that which we must be careful of. Then we have a full picture.
Okay.
But that is my suggestion, Chair, and I'm sure I represent my colleagues from ASA.
No further comments before I make the ruling. Okay, let's
Chairperson, thank you very much. I don't know maybe what is it I'm seconding to what Honorable Tim is saying. But on a point that if we're going to allow the SIU just to brief us on an open, as much as we are open, if the report hasn't arrived at the president, then I think maybe we will be starting on a wrong footing. And be in the manner that like Advocate Jenkins has said, but at the same time, then you will be then opening a can of worms even before we start with the inquiry. So my suggestion would be that maybe he just speak about the overview, probably per se, and I don't know, maybe because we're saying it's even open, we are, all of us who are here, but also we also have some other stakeholders that we used to work with, which the report was supposed to be prior, probably maybe to the members of parliament, and then maybe I don't know, but I just have some a little bit of discomfort at Chairperson that it is being really put as it is clear openly. So thank you.
Comrade Mente.
Chair, thank you very much. I need some clarity first. Is this the document that hasn't been to the president?
Comment?
Is this a general document or is this the investigation that must still be disclosed to the president or what?
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, in that presentation, some of the information you'll see that we focus on two proclamations, the previous one, 2012. The matters under that proclamation are contained in the presidential report that has been submitted to the president a while back. The second proclamation, the 2016 one, which focuses on two areas, Gauteng, human settlement, and the Belle Northern Water, the investigations are still underway. So we have not submitted the report to the president as yet. But just to go back to the 2012 one, having submitted the report, there's one aspect in that investigation that is still outstanding. It relates to the Vuani area. So that aspect we are closing down now, and then we'll submit a supplementary report to the president, just to close the 2012 one. 2016, still underway. Chair, I think I would pause here.
Yes, government.
Well, in that case, Chair, it's only one part of the presentation that should be not disclosed. Can we then be guided on which part of it that must not be disclosed at this moment, and we deal with everything else? Because my fear is we want the success of the inquiry. And if then we start tampering with investigations, they will be of no use to us. They can be easily contested. But my fear also is that how are we then going to retract or withdraw these parts from the distribution that has been done? Are we sure it's only us that have distributed this document or is everybody else? Because if this document is already distributed, how do we withdraw it? And we are tampering with investigation.
The process has not as yet started, but it is proving to be complex. I guess it has to do with how things are going to be like. Mr. Ross?
Thank you, Chair. If I look at the strategic intent of the proposed inquiry, certainly it is to achieve some consequence management in a department that has completely collapsed. That's my view. And now we have the situation, and as you say, a very complex situation, where we have proclamations that's being referred to the president, and we've seen that this is in a rather historic consequences that there has been no action from the previous president with regards to reviews in presidential proclamations. So we are heading towards a stalemate situation where we need to to grant the current president the opportunity to finalize the presidential proclamations and the SIU to do a thorough investigation. On the other hand, we sit with a situation which I would term as time is of the essence, where we need this inquiry into a collapsed department. So I think we have to balance these balls that are in the air, and I would really like the two chairpersons to give us guidance what you think, how we should go about it. Certainly it would be of no use to have a full inquiry with the strategic intent to have consequence management on ministers who has collapsed the department, and we still have to await the presidential proclamations and the final outcomes. We just need to be very honest whether we should go into the full inquiry or what are the stumbling blocks in getting an open and transparent inquiry and empowering the committee to do their job.
Conrad Kagan?
No, thanks, Chair. Chair, I may be also uncomfortable. That is to proceed with this SIU briefing, knowing for a fact that there is a possibility that we might be challenged. My proposal would then be, earlier on you said you would need some legal opinion on this. I don't know whether the advocate was giving us an opinion on the matter, or he was just commenting. But if he was giving, he was commenting, I would then suggest that maybe he consults with his legal gurus, and they give us a proper legal opinion that is on this matter as to how to go about on this issue. And whilst they are still maybe doing that, we then have the two other departments, that is AG and that is National Treasury. And if it is possible for them to complete or to conclude, that is their consultation, whilst we are still busy with the two, then we can get feedback and know exactly as to how to proceed. Because I'm a bit worried that if we proceed knowing that there is a possibility of this whole process being challenged, then it is a futile exercise.
I want us to take that route. Let's allow the AG's office, let us allow National Treasury, and then Advocate Jenkins assist us in the course of that whole process, or just as when the last two are done. Are we fine with that, Advocate Jenkins? Okay. Okay, members, let's then continue with our processes. Yeah, can we do that?
Take them back, but understanding that is a journalist. They know exactly what is in here.
Okay, let's do it this way, Comrade Kekana. Let us not create any debate. Let us just bring those documents without any debate about it. Okay, fine. We can do that quietly. AG's office, as you can see, you are already ready. Mr. Mukwet?
Good morning, joint chairs and members of the two committees. Our invitation to this meeting, Chair, was very specific. You asked us to attend and brief you on the audit work that we had been doing over the years at the Department of Water and Sanitation, including the outcomes of the most recent audit that we did for the year that ended in 2017. There were specific areas that you asked us to pay attention to, and the presentation that we are bringing forth today is going to expand on those areas. Among them is the area of instability in leadership in that portfolio. You asked also some detailed insights based on the audit work that we have done on the area of irregular expenditure. You also were interested in the use of implementing agents as we see them through the audit. Human resource issues, they will certainly not be exhaustive, but those specific elements within the human resource environment that we know will weigh in on the control environment within water and sanitation. We'll also give you some insight into our assessment of the state of internal controls and financial viability of the department. Those were the specific areas, Chair, that you wanted us to cover. I just wanted to make sure that we're all on the same page as far as that scope is concerned, so that if somebody else thought there were other things that we ought to have spoken about, we basically prepared ourselves limited by the specific areas you requested. So this presentation, therefore, Chair, is a feedback to yourselves on that request, and we understood it that you wanted to use the audit insights that we have developed over the period to position yourselves in respect of the work that you are going to be undertaking. If I go to page 3 of this presentation, where there are a number of issues, as I've said, which will become the subject of today's presentation, starting from the history of the outcomes of the audit in the portfolio, right down to the feedback on the issues pertaining to complaints that were raised, among others, during the course of the work of the audit that we've done. I'm now on page 5 of the presentation, where we are highlighting for the past 3 years, looking at the department itself, in addition to the water boards and also the outcomes of the likes of the TCTA right at the bottom of that slide on page 5. You are familiar, obviously, Chair, many of us in the meeting, with the annotation that we use to describe the different audit outcomes of the different entities, as you see on that page. Effectively, over a 3-year period, if you look at the department itself, back in 2014-15, it was a qualified situation, meaning that the auditors had some serious misgivings with regards to certain numbers reported in the financial statements. And the year after, 2015-16, there was a ray of light that quickly disappeared again in 2016-17 as far as those controls are concerned. And that's why you see that purple in the column 2016-17. It means that as far as the financial statements are concerned, the auditors have looked at them, but were not completely satisfied with adherence to specific manner in which certain transactions have to be accounted for. And we'll deal with the detail of those. Some of them are the area of irregular expenditure. And again, as I speak about the current period, you'll also see that among the water boards, there were quite a number that also attracted qualifications, the likes of Liepele Northern, Mshatuze, Sedibeng Water. And I think if you flag those ones in particular, you'll see in the detail of the presentation, there are specific matters that were always highlighted during the course of the audits as the major deviations from the systems of internal control in those particular water boards. Water Research Commission is still a fairly well managed as far as the finances and financial disciplines are concerned. So that's the overall picture as far as the interface between some of these water boards as well as the department, because in some instances you'll see quite a lot of activity between those water boards and their purchasing of bulk water, for example, from the likes of TCTA and stuff. So the report that we are giving also attempts to give you an insight into the relationship between them, how they work together, but also how they work between themselves in terms of their financial management disciplines. The other point, Chair, on the next slide, which is slide number 7, relates to another matter that you asked us to flag as far as the journey over the years is concerned. You will recall that we often highlight the matter pertaining to what is attributable to some of the audit outcomes that we often report on. The issue of instability of leadership, where certain commitments are made with regard to the fixing of the internal control environment, has historically been one of those, at least in this portfolio. If you look at the number of changes as well as the number of movements at some of the critical areas of oversight as far as financial management is concerned, and also the role of the accounting officer there. The audit outcomes over the period on the same slide also speak to that evidence of years of instability of leadership sometimes contribute to the deterioration in the systems of financial management and internal control. The real essence of it, Chair, is that those that make commitments and are responsible for driving the implementation of programs, when they move on and they are no longer in those roles, there's always sometimes even a loss of documentation to provide evidence for certain transactions. And these are some of the issues which we think in looking at the audit outcomes versus the instability at leadership level draws attention to some of the risks that often result in financial loss. Below that level, we've also tried to paint a picture as far as the human resource environment is concerned. To what extent have there been firm leadership at various levels at DDGs? And I guess that's the level where the bulk of the direction with regards to the implementation of various programs will be driven. And fairly stable insofar as the players are concerned, as one can see over the years. And I guess if one looks for institutional memory and knowledge pertaining to any matters that you might want to inquire, there will well be a number of people at DDG level who have been part of the journey, especially when it comes to some of the medium to long-term contracts. Notably, within the human resource environment, I guess some movements have taken place with vacancies, and long many periods of vacancy have been experienced also while there were still people in those positions. So some periods where you found people acting in these positions also tends to be a direct contributor to kind of stuff that is experienced during the audit, where nobody knows where this decision came because I was not in this role for the last 9 months, so-and-so was. And these are some of the issues that we thought will be important for you because they disrupt the normal flow of internal control activity when they are not given due attention. That's the human resource space, Chair. I guess you probably are asking why are you focusing on this. I guess the issue is whatever transaction was entered into, it either was initiated by somebody and was probably authorized by another, and the payment that arose as a result of that particular transaction would also have been effected by another. So that's the context that we wanted to paint here as far as when you look back to some of them, you will find that there is no shortage of people who can provide the necessary responses should those questions arise. On page 13 of the presentation, where we deal with the subject of irregular expenditure, the focus here, Chair, one is to say that there was a time when irregular expenditure was neither here nor there. I think that's the essence of what that slide is telling us. And if you look to the period 09-10, this is also maybe to assist you to have a sense of what scope, area, and period you want to examine in respect of your plans. But if one looks at the period 09-10, there was virtually limited, if any, irregular expenditure. And I guess as you look at that graph climbing since the 2013-14 reporting period and making a very sharp rise in the most recent period as far as the elements of irregular expenditure are concerned. Not that the years prior to it were not significant, but I think in relation to the upshoot that you see from 2014-15 onwards, it is clearly that period where some of these major awards that fell foul of the audit would have been identified. one of the key highlights in any one of the reports that you are referring to over the period is matters where, for example, the five elements that make up for what is required in the Constitution as far as supply chain is concerned on page 14, many of them were not observed. Some of them fell foul of what we consider as a fair assessment with regards to the different layers that put up the bids for this work, equitable and just distribution, transparency and competitiveness. These are the elements that we normally focus on in determining whether a particular procurement is in line with the requirements of the Constitution in Section 216. And these are the issues that we are, you're going to find in our report, focusing on the fact that there were no competitive bids. Some of them were responding to directives that were issued, and I deal with that on the next page, on page 15, where we look at the different water boards and the number of directives that were issued in respect of ministerial directives that we came across during the course of the audit. You spoke earlier about the I made reference to Sedibeng, Mhlatuze, and Lipile. If you look at their audit outcomes as those water boards, these are some of those that were recipients of these directives, where they had to procure some of the programs that they were implementing via some directives. And of course, they come with certain compliance requirements. The fact that it's a directive is not the end in itself. It is a directive that ought to be carried out in compliance with certain requirements. The area of irregular expenditure at the water trading entity, certainly on page 16, we also pay closer attention to the quantifiable amounts in respect of those that were as a result of deviations that were approved not in accordance with Treasury regulations. We've quantified the amount to just reflect on what makes up that 2.4 billion. You'll see a number of other categories of issues that were not complied with insofar as supply chain is concerned. We list all of them, and we put in place the amount attributable to that particular area. For example, contract and management, the procurement of unlimited SAP licenses was one of those that were also identified during the audit, with a quantifiable figure sitting at about 450 million, as well as irregular expenditure that was incurred at some of the implementing agents, which we draw attention to for Sedibeng and Lepile Northern Water. That deals with the just a reflection, Chair, and I'm doing this in a little bit of a high level, but with some insight on it, because I'm aware that the team in the office has been here almost every 2 weeks, they say, coming to brief the Committee on Water Affairs, but I thought it would be good to have the same background as to what is contained in those audit reports. The next one I deal with is on infrastructure projects. Some of them, Chair, you will recall we did as part of our performance audit that we tabled with the Committee on Water Affairs, I think in 2016, where we picked up also during the course of our audit specific projects that were being implemented within the water environment, and have reported on those after we have assessed the economy, the efficiency and the effectiveness with which they were delivered. And this is over and above what we had identified during the course of the statutory financial statement audit. There's a report that you probably would have had access to that speaks to these specific programs in specific provinces where there are specific findings that were made, where we focus on whether value for money would have been achieved. And this is when we used the services of some of the experts in the area of water to be able to give us a direct technical interpretation of what we were picking up in the form of a audit. So these infrastructure projects, without spending too much time on them, I think will become part of your tools that you need to use in terms of the observations that had been made by the audit as we did the performance audit on them. Just as a key focus, Chair, on page 21 of the slide presentation, we do this analysis also in that same report I'm referring to, which was a performance audit report, where we look at the likes of your Giani project, the Nwamitwa Dam, as well as the raising of the Tzanin Dam. A lot of the findings which weigh in on issues of efficiency and economy are contained in that report. But just to highlight some of those findings that were made, part of them are to do with project management fees that during the course of the audit, when the examination was done, were considered to be excessive. Some professional fees and rates, when you compare them to other comparable data, and norms in respect of such kind of professional fees elsewhere, we found a disproportionate link between what was being paid on some of these projects versus what was described, for example, in your public service regulations insofar as the rates and the parameters within which certain professional fees ought to be paid. So in essence, Chair, when you look at the area of fruitless and wasteful expenditure, it is that kind of excess expenditure that we are drawing attention to, where we say that payments were made, but the requisite value does not measure up to the cost incurred. Mopani project, among others, as you can see, those three bullets is largely dealing with issues of the accounting treatment for project costs, as well as the accounting for assets that were constructed by the water trading entity. This is the kind of issues in an audit that we would normally highlight and set out in the area to deal with financial management and financial statement issues. Again, on similar projects, there's also an identification of specific areas and levels of irregular expenditure, attaching again to the likes of the Giani project, the Nwamitwa, and so on. So, Chair, those are some of the specific issues that the audit had focused on, and I thought that if there was any need for specific detail on them, the team leader on the audit would certainly assist us if we wanted to get a deeper sense on the issues that we highlight. But suffice to say that the issues that we highlight in the 16-17 audit report are a litany of evidence coming over the years in respect of non-compliance with specific requirements and financial management, and we are happy to expand on any of them should you need us to. Let me leave it at that, Chair, and say that the rest is just an expansion of some of those issues that I already referred to. Thanks very much.
Thanks, AG. Comrades, any questions for clarity? I don't know how to say it was clear and straightforward. The major task is for us to say what do we lift out of the presentation. But if there's any question that comrades may want to ask, for clarity, not discussion. Ross?
Chairperson, just for clarity, I note that the irregular expenditure, as you correctly said, AG, that since 2014-15 and especially in the 16-17 year has escalated to unacceptable levels. But when, in terms of all these indicators, when could we pick up that the department was actually not being able to be classified as a going concern? The going concern issue. How can we couple the going? We are extremely concerned that the department's completely collapsed. When should that have been picked up in terms of the financial statements? Just the going concern issue in terms of the dates and noting the irregular expenditure. From which date would you say the department was could be classified as not a going concern?
All right, Comrade Mente.
Thanks, Chair. I just on page 19 where they are listing the key infrastructure projects, are there any others that they know of? Because I do not see some of the projects that were listed in, I think, 2015-2016 audit report. the double payments. For instance, Crisani Water, Eastern Cape. I don't see the Northern Cape, Kuruman. There is a Kuruman water project and one water project as well in KZN and Kanyakude. There's a municipality in there. There's those three that I could remember. Secondly, the Libel on page 16, the irregular expenditure on Libel Northern Water. Which project is this one? Because they have various projects. So which one is this that's indicated here?
Which one? Comrade Kekane and who else? That's two. All right. So it will be Comrade Kekane and...
It's just a clarity, AG, on the... And thank you very much for this briefing. On the deviations that were approved not in accordance with the Treasury regulations, at the one of 975 million, and I just wanted to understand, is it the same one that is related to the Giani project? Because the Giani project is in terms of, when you check the slide 20, the project is not even near the completion. When we were checking with them during the audit, is it in relation to that one, or is another deviation for something else for the 2015-16 and going forward? It's just on that one. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Come back to that.
No, thanks, Chair. Thanks for the presentation. Mine is just clarity on page 16 in terms of the scope. Which financial year are we referring to? That is the only issue that I need clarity on.
All right, thanks. So, Yauma.
Thank you very much, Chair. My clarity, DG, will be with all of these findings, normally what will then happen is that between yourself and the department, in particular the accounting officer, there will be therefore a commitment to address these findings with a particular plan that the department will then put in place to begin to address these issues. One, obvious, your fruitless, wasteful expenditure. If we follow PFMA to the latter, obvious, we'll then instruct you that there will be an investigation, there will be action that must be taken against those that are found to have caused the irregular expenditure, fruitless or wasteful, and there will be action to recover. I want to, just to share with us your experience, obvious, because you are really giving us an overall picture of the status of the department. What is the position there? The second one, obvious, with the current, the executive authority, the current new minister now, have you had time to share with him these issues? I'm not saying that we're not privy as a committee, but I'm trying to have these issues sort of understood by even the current executive. Have you had time to share with them the state of the audit of that department? My point, in fact, is linked to the earlier point of which I think you may want to elaborate maybe further around your view on the going concern of this department. You may want to elaborate the AGR so that members of the committee even have an understanding of where you stand in now. What is your view on this department?
Okay. Comrade Kuno.
Listen, I could have come in earlier, but I've been re-asking myself this question over and over, so I'm thinking out loud. So I hope I'm allowed to popote, because I'm thinking out loud. And my popote part is that, according to you, we've had a problem as a committee on deviations and expansions, and we think that they are costing government a lot more money than if things were done normally. And I wanted to hear your view as the Auditor General of South Africa. How do you see the deviations? That's point number one. Number two, Chairperson, I was trying to get hold of the annual report. I don't have it now. But I know that previously when we dealt with water and sanitation, there were projects that were not paid for. But services had already been rendered. So I just need to know, it might not be relevant for the AG. I just need to know, when you're looking at the deviations, the double payment, vis-a-vis those projects that have not been paid but the services have been rendered, how do you then help with that situation? Because as we said earlier on in our introductions and when we were asking questions, if we should proceed with the meeting per the SIU thing, the main question, we all know that the department is in serious problems. So I just want to know and get what is the feel of the AG and how can he advise us.
AG?
Thank you very much, Chair. in elaborating on the specific detail and clarity on the pages that you referred to, I'm going to ask my colleague to help in that one. But let's start with the with the questions that were raised regarding going concern. When you look at the audit of a department,
just a minute, Comrade, can we request that we switch off our cellular phones so that they don't do what they're doing now? Yes, AG, may continue.
Now, Chair, when we look at the overall evaluation of an audit, which is at that point when a matter around going concern might arise. At the time, we know that this department gets funded via an appropriation, and that is a constitutional imperative. It will be funded because it's not about the department, it's also about the people that it must service. So the issues of going concern here, if one wants to have a very good understanding of, they probably are questions like, what is putting strain to the fiscus, in essence? Because going concern as a concept is largely attributable to entities that are going out on business on the back of a shareholder who, because of subsequent and many losses that are being incurred, may no longer have the money to bail out that entity. Whereas here, the tax gets collected, it gets put into the National Revenue Fund, and when there are financial strains in a particular department, all it does, it puts an additional strain on the fiscus. I think that's really the context of that question insofar as going concern. So we don't really pay too much attention because we know that next year there will be a tax bill that proposes all sorts of things that must be collected in order to meet the constitutional obligations that these departments are carrying. So what we're looking at then, if you look at our slide presentation, we look at the area that talks about financial sustainability. And the question is, the financial position of this department is significantly strained, largely by the fact that there have been many deviations from financial management disciplines over the years that have not been attended to. Things like duplicate payments, payments that are made for contracts that may not be complete. All of those things added together, if it was a self-funding environment, your going concern risk would be definitely elevated. There are no other shareholders here. It's just the department where there are people who are employed and others who have got a policy job to do. So in answer to that question is that we see a lot of these irregular expenditures, and the fact that many of them are also payments made without requisite value, it means that the fiscus must now provide for the same thing that it provided for the previous year. And that's the kind of strain I'm talking about. It is that effect, I think, that it has on them. As far as the issue of commitments made to address these findings, what is our experience as the office with the accounting officers? You will see when I was going through that particular slide on stability of leadership. Unfortunately, the conversations that we have had, we've either had them with somebody who is acting just for a little period, and when we come back, when the statutory audit starts, we then find somebody else who has got a different priority in relation to the issues that we raised with the previous person. So we try and work with that incumbent at that time until 9 months later that other person as well is also not there. And so it goes. You'll see the average tenure at those levels has been somewhere around one is here for 6 months, another for nine, another for 15, and all and all and all and all. Before you know it, the one that was there comes back again. Now, you not start from the commitment that you made with them 21 months ago. You start with whatever the new priorities are. So you've been not successful, even though there was an intention to do the things that were recommended. But the reality is that it never materialized because they were not around long enough to see to that commitment. And I think, Chair, one of the things that we have also observed in the environment when we look at the commitment to deal with our audit outcomes, you're dealing with an environment with a lot of suppliers that are technical in nature, that require ongoing supervision to make sure that they stick to what has been agreed, because they deal with complex issues most of the time. If they have to do a rehabilitation of a dam, it's not like a rehabilitation of anything. There are all sorts of engineering things that get into that. So when you've got lesser levels of stability, sometimes certain service providers might encroach into an initial scope and expand themselves into the environment and start getting to other things that were not intended initially when they came in on the initial scope. And I think that's where the bulk of the risk is. And if you had stability at leadership level, as you see here, at least the DDGs is not that much of a challenge. And I think the question is, what sort of level of supervisory work is happening within a portfolio like this? Because you're not dealing with people who are supplying catering for a meeting. That's probably easy to manage and control because you know how many people are going to there and you know whether they did go. But with an engineering project, there may be long leads of time of planning before the actual execution happens. Now, if the person was involved when the negotiations were happening as to the timing of the delivery after the planning was done, and before you know it, there are different players there, it has its own impact in terms of the cost of the program and the ability to have the necessary follow through. So the vacancies also, in addition, Chair, I think are another factor where you try and build this momentum, because the long-term nature of these things has also got a financial impact that is long-term as well. While you are busy delivering something, the end of that project may be 3, 4, 5 years down the line. And I think those are the things that we have found a limited number of, the levels of supervision over these projects. We have not really had a chance to engage with the current executive authority. And last time we made an attempt, and it was starting to get closer to an engagement that we thought was going to embrace these issues. We then, as we all know, discovered somebody else there, so we have not yet had a chance to interact with the new executive authority. How do I see these deviations? Chair, I think if one looks at deviations in principles, when rules are made, especially for things like supply chain, they are unlikely to have a line of sight into every possible scenario that might arise. Hence the space for deviations. But I think the issue that is important, I think, to consider with deviations is that a deviation is doing something else other than what was prescribed. So that something else has got its own problems. When someone allows for you to do something else in the form of a deviation, they normally impose an additional responsibility on you to disclose further information or to take into account additional factors now that you have not gone the prescribed route. The issue that we have found with deviations generally is that when people see a deviation is allowed as it should, they sometimes do not want to carry that additional responsibility of additional disclosure, additional information, and additional steps that need to be taken in order for you to be within the rules, even though you have deviated.
I think the question was, what is my view
on deviations? And that is my view on deviations. They are an allowable creature, but if the additional responsibilities that come with them are not adhered to, the system remains exposed as if somebody was deliberately deviating from the set rule. So the fact that it's a deviation and it has been approved by somebody higher up is neither here nor there. It's just a mechanical exercise in most instances. What is important is the qualitative elements that come with an additional reporting responsibility is what is often missing. And that additional responsibility is often about safeguarding the system and the financial environment from possible abuse in the event that a deviation is actioned. Payments not made for services rendered. I think it's the cry that many of these service providers have had. We've come across, if you look at the report that we issued on the performance audit, instances where service providers move away from site while they are providing services. When they do not get paid, they leave site and leave that particular delivery of the project unfinished. There are instances, I think, we picked up in one of the water delivery projects, I think in the northern water, Lipiele or Giani, one of them. So there are instances of those, and the most devastating part of it is that what was in progress, among others, gets aborted because that supplier is unable to continue to pay their own workers, including buying additional materials if they do not get paid at the time that was promised. So at the extent of them, Honorable Member, I'm sure my colleague, when he elaborates on the specific numbers, he will give you a sense of the extent of prevalence of this matter. But let me hand over to him, Chair, so he can give additional insight on the other specific issues.
Good morning, Honorable Chairpersons, Honorable Members. My name is Andries Segeto. I'm from the Office of the Auditor General. I'm a business executive responsible for, amongst others, the water and sanitation portfolio. To my left, I've got Mr. Stephen Clay, who's the senior manager for the water trading entity. And to his left is Ms. Sure Tayar, who's the senior manager responsible for the audit of the department itself, the Department of Water and Sanitation. So, Honorable Chairperson, we'll be answering some of the detailed questions and with the assistance of my team as well. Just with in building on what the AG has already answered, Honorable Ross's question, Honorable Ross can also refer to page 4. Just maybe by point of administration as well, Honorable Chairperson. Honorable Chairperson, we've not only handed out the slides, but we've also handed out the detailed report, the Word document. So the two documents must be read in conjunction with each other, and we can also refer to page 4 of the Word document for a little bit more in-depth assessment with regard to the going concern. I think Honorable Ross also asked by when it should have been picked up in terms of the going concern assessment, and the AG has alluded to the fact that, the focus is on where we put strain on the fiscus and when it becomes apparent. So you always have departments that have a little bit more overspending in terms of the current allocation, but normally there are some norms within which they, or parameters within which they operate, and within the water and sanitation environment, those norms were exceeded alarmingly so, only recently over the past two or one financial year. And hence, if you refer back to our audit report of the previous financial year, you'll actually know that we do mention something in terms of the going concern in the audit report. But again, the reporting would be different than to a private sector, but because in the private sector, there's no more input or there's limited input from where additional funds would come from, whereas for the fiscus, there's a taxpayer's element, as the AGS has alluded to. And then in reference to that, you can also refer to slide number 41, to slide number 43 of the actual slides of the handout we've handed out, where we give the assessment of the going concern and also allude to the fact that before the department even starts spending in the current year, they would be required to recover or claw back accruals of approximately 1.1 billion already from the current allocation. So they need to spend about 1 billion paying invoices from the previous financial year for services rendered before they can actually proceed with the implementation of the current financial year. As far as the question was raised with regard to certain key infrastructure, we do obviously the audit process being on a sample basis, we only sample certain key projects. We don't visit all the entire projects that are on the department's implementation list. We went through a criteria where we identified certain high-risk or high-level or high-value projects, and those are the ones where we focused on, and hence the feedback is only limited to those key projects that we identified and we did actual work on, and hence we didn't cover those projects as Honourable Member requested. Then, as part of the audit process, when we found certain shortcomings or deficiencies in a process based on our sample, we then refer the department back or our entities back to go back to the entire population to revisit and see if there are similar risks which will then be prevalent in your environment. So the onus is then up to the department or the officials to go back and see, based on what we've identified for them, if there are other similar projects where similar risks then exist. So, and that's why then it's important, I think Honorable Kakana asked the question with regard to the action plans. So we've identified something, what is your action going to be in dealing with what has been reported to you? As far as the actual action plan for the current financial year was concerned, we actually had a challenge where the department did not fully develop an action plan covering all the areas reported to them by the Office of the AG, because they were disputing the findings. So they were always of the opinion that they don't agree with the findings issued, and therefore if you look at the action plan did not address these issues as of the irregular expenditure and the fruitless and wasteful expenditure to the extent that it should have as reported by us to them. As recent as January or February, when it had audit committee meetings, the audit committee even raised a concern to the management of the department that the action plans were not forthcoming or were not to the required level of sufficient detail to deal with these issues that were reported by the Office of the AG. And then with regard to the deviations noted on slide 16, what is key to note on slide 16, Honourable Members, is the fact that on slide 16, the 2.4 billion that we've included as part of this information is what the audit team has reported to management of the WTE, but has also not been disclosed in the annual report of the department or the WTE. So in essence, if you refer to page 283 of the annual report of the department and the WTE, whatever balance they have disclosed there for fruitless irregular expenditure does not include that 2.4 billion. And this 2.4 billion is based on factual evidence that the team has done and reported to management. Management were disputing it. National Treasury may also provide some context, because they even referred some of the matters to the National Treasury, despite some very clear guidance in the regard of areas of dispute as well. So the 2.4 billion was reported to management, and it was not disclosed in the financial statement. The second part of the question was to which projects these related to. It related to various projects. We looked at the process. For example, the BIT Education Committee did not sit. So because of the control that is not working, it could impact whatever process or project has run through for approval through that BIT Education Committee. So from that point of view, it impacts on a number of projects, not just limited to the ones that we've mentioned, like the Giani project. And then I think that also deals with the next question Honorable Kakana asked on slide 16, to say which scope was it. It was for the 16-17 financial year, the audit that we recently did, where we picked up a number of these things. Some of the irregular expenditure has been coming from previous financial years, because remember, irregular expenditure, if you've done the instance of non-compliance in the 1 year and you continue paying on that contract, you will still need to disclose the irregular expenditure in the year of payment linked to that non-compliance instance. And then, I think the AG has adequately dealt with the new executive. However, I would like to add that we are in constant communication with at least the DG, or the acting DG. We have, through the acting DG, sort of tried to pave the way for communicating or escalating some of the key issues to the new minister through engagements that we've had with the DG. So from our point of view, we assume that they follow the same process where if anything comes to light, we brief our principal that they are doing the same, even though maybe we would not have had the opportunity to engage one-on-one with the new minister, to brief the new minister. And then with regard to the instabilities, I'd also like to add, with regard to the instabilities, the Institute of Race Relations actually also did a study with regard to stability and relationship between minister and a DG or accounting officer. And there's a table in there in that report that actually highlights the term or the number of months where there was an acting DG in all the departments across national government. And the Department of Water and Sanitation actually tops that term there, because over the past 6 or 7 financial years, there's been an acting DG for a period combined of 56 months. Now, if you add 56 months, that's almost close to 5 years. So for a period of 6 to 7 years, for 5 years, you've had a term of acting DGs, which is the highest in of all the studies that were done, just to provide some context with regard to the people's ability to take decision and make sure that they act with authority when required to. I think if there's anything else that we've missed, we'll throw it open again, but
we can have it. Okay. No, that's fine. Can I allow the last two comrades? Let's remember that the objective of the exercise is for us to be able to lift out what we may need to. Comrade Mentor, you want to make a follow-up? Then okay, and then Comrade Nguni, so that we can go to National Treasurer. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Can you please clarify the 467 million of the Liphele? Is it one project or is it various projects on page 16? And as well as from the information now that you've just shared with us in terms of the research and the study that was done by another body, did you at any point come across unlawful instructions or an unlawful instruction given to you as a reason for irregular expenditure or asking deviation or an expansion? Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. You know, part of our exercise as a joint committee is to work out what period we're going to do this over. And obviously we want to try and extract from what you're talking about, what Treasury is talking about. So are you with me? Okay. We need to be one mind. And so I just want to ask you one question. One particular project that is concerning me is the Vuani steel pipeline project. That originated in about 2012. And the reason why it's important is that the SIU are currently in court with the current DDG and the contractors to the tune of 140 million rand. So what is your... Do you believe that we should include that in our ambit of the inquiry? Because I know that there's a feeling that we should start in 2014 or something, which, you know, obviously is where it really got bad. But maybe this raises a question. Are there specific projects that maybe outside of, let's say, 2014 starting line up to now that we should have a look at as significant exceptions, as it were? If you could just give us your input on that, thank you.
All right, that's Comrade. Then Comrade Kulo, and we...
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Given the nature of performance,
that the department has achieved. Did you ever look at the performance bonuses given to the DGs, more especially there are those that have been occupying permanently, consistently, on all the on some of the programs? Did they ever get the bonuses for anything or approve those things in your audit? Thank you very much.
Okay.
As part of the investigation, as part of the investigations that have been made, we were told last year, I forgot when water and sanitation came before SCOFA, there's a particular company, LTE, which is getting a lot of projects through deviations. But, you know, it's a company that will cost a borehole that you'll find a lokshin, 20,000 at 3 million rand, one borehole. And we're told that is a Rolls Royce. And it took, instead of, that's why I was emphasizing earlier on that there were projects that have not been paid for. And those that were paid for were overpaid. You know, the double payments that you talked about. So I'm not sure as that investigation, if you are also looking into that so that you can help us get into the bottom of this.
All right. Ross?
Listen, my question is with regard to the funding models of the water trading entities. And it's quite clear if we look at the defaulting municipalities paying these entities, and I'm just taking Citibank for an example where there was a non-payment from the municipalities. AG, how can you assist us in terms of the funding models? And I've noticed also there was an augmentation fund with regards to this. We now see in the department that we have annual appropriations to the department, and that could save it as a going concern, as to speak. But the water trading entities, are they completely dependent on the payment of delivering the bulk supply and then being paid by the municipalities, and what is the risk in this involved, and how can we mitigate those circumstances? And in our inquiry with the department and entities going forward, I think we need to focus, Chairperson, also on this issue, the defaulting municipalities and the impact on the water trading entities.
Alright.
On deviations, AG earlier on, maybe I couldn't pronounce myself clearly. You have deviations that are costing the 64 billion rand across. The problem is that it talks to non-planning of departments, and you find that's the time when they take service they are forcing service providers into a particular entity or a department. In other words, instead of taking another newcomers that can come in and play and be part of the players, then they will make sure that, you know, they close gaps for those players. So that's why it's a problem. So I really want us to, when we talk about deviations later on when we deal with Usoli, we have this background and your advice as the AG with the background that I've just given. Thanks.
But IG.
But thank you, Honourable Chairpersons. The first set of questions which were asked with regard to the 467 million, yes, that includes the Nwamita Dam and Lepele as well, in terms of that 467 million. And then the unlawful instruction. As part of our audit work, we haven't come across that. Obviously, you hear corridor talk, but we can't attest to it because there's nothing on paper. However, during our engagement, as Office of the AG, when we started looking in depth into irregular expenditure, you would come across a situation where a minister would request officials to do something. And then the next morning when you get to the office, you would find there's new furniture and, you know, new decisions have been taken. And then when you engage the officials and you say, listen, you incur irregular expenditure, they would say it's on instruction of the minister is the root cause. Then you go and you have your discussions with your ministers, and as we were doing that to try and analyze and get to the real root cause, the ministers or the political leadership would just say, I said I want this done. Officials are responsible for following processes. Therefore, when I say I want something done, I did not mean go and break the laws and regulations. So then it becomes a he says, she says story. And from this point of view, what we have found specifically relating to the Department of Water and Sanitation is there was a ministerial directive issued. A directive in itself, as AG has alluded to, does not necessarily mean go and break the laws and regulations. It says there's this particular need, go and address this particular need. However, we do not know what happens behind closed doors. We would like to, however, in the interest of or in the vein of the discussion of the directive, highlight to the members or take the members' attention to slide number 27. Now, if the members consider slide number 27, which deals with the Lepele Northern Water, which appointed a contractor or service provider, for the purpose of the briefing, I must also highlight to the committee that because of the dispute resolution process and the fact that the AG was taken to court by some of the service providers, we did not include the service providers' names in there, but however, I see that the committee is well versed with some of the service providers' names. So, as part of that assessment, we looked at the appointment for Lepele Northern Water, which was issued in terms of a directive. On slide 27, what you would expect typically to happen in terms of the contractual documentation, the department would issue the directive, the department would then approve the funding, then between the department and the implementing agent, there would be an agreement to agree on the scope. Lepele Northern Water, if then it is deviating because it was deemed as an emergency, you would then request the deviation from procurement processes, providing your justifiable and reasonable reasons, and then you appoint your contractor. Once the contractor is appointed, you agree with the contractor what the scope is that the contractor is going to cover, and then if the contractor then accepts your terms, you sign a service level agreement or a contract, and then the contractor appoints a subcontractor if they want to appoint a subcontractor and if it was allowed. So that's the flow as part of the first diagram there. What actually happened in this environment was on the 15th of August 2014, Lepele Northern Water had already agreed the scope with the particular service provider. Okay. Once that had been done, on the 19th of August, Lepele Northern Water then requested a deviation from the department. Once the deviation had been requested, they immediately proceeded the next day, on the 20th of August, to appoint their service provider. Only once the service provider had been appointed, did evidence come to light with regards to the funding. I mean, you're first supposed to make sure that you've got adequate funding available before you then go and proceed to appoint your service providers. And then that was on the 24th of, I think it says October. Yeah, October. But also, the department only issued a directive on the 25th of August. So once all the appointments had been done and the scope had been agreed. And then on the 23rd of September, Lepele Northern Water had signed SLA with a company, and the company then proceeded to appoint a subcontractor. And it's also important to note that you've got Lepele, then you've got the service provider, which is Company A, and they also then proceeded to appoint a subcontractor. Why that is important to note is, if you look at it, it therefore means that your project management fees on the project are escalated, because now you have Lepele Northern Water claiming 5%, and then you have the private consulting firm claiming 3%, and then that service provider, which is now deemed or noted as Company A, also claiming 3%. Combined, you're paying 11% of your project cost on project management fees compared to industry norms, which are between 3 and 5%. What we further then did is we looked at the total amount that you would pay for project management fees on the project, and then we actually took that in terms of hours spent. And if you do that calculation, you realize in terms of the public works rate that the department could have actually appointed 46 full-time principal project managers for the amount they spent on Lepele and Northern Water. For the amount they're spending on Company A, they could have appointed 28 full-time people. For the amount they're spending on the consultant firm, also 28. So in total, they could have appointed approximately 102 full-time project management people for the amount they spent to outside people. Okay. And then, with regard to the Vuane Steel Project 1, Unfortunately, they did not form part of our sample for the projects we selected. The projects we selected are included as part of slide number 19. So those are the 10 projects we focused on in the current financial year. Then, as far as whether it should be included or not, if there are red flags that the committee has identified, then from our point of view, it would be highly recommended that they be considered for inclusion. However, we cannot make the decision for the committee. The committee must then assess the evidence that's available in this, at the committee's disposal to make that assess or conclusion. And then, I think I've dealt with a company that was mentioned in terms of the name. However, in dealing with the excessive rates, some of the findings we found and on that project in Giyane are included in slide number 30, where the approval processes were made towards the end of August, but you have people charging full 160 hours for the month. So all appointments were only done towards the end of the month. However, the invoices were as if the people had been working and all paperwork had been done from the first of the month. Over and above that, you have one person who would charge for the full month for project management services and then would also charge for the full month for engineering services. Now, if you take it, how many months are available? I mean, there are only so many hours available in a day. You have one resource charging 160 hours for the month for project management services and then another 160 again for engineering services, which is why we raised the red flag with regard to overpayment in this regard. And then, also in line with the overpayment, is on slide number 31, where on slide number 31, we did a benchmarking exercise in terms of the rate. So not only were the hours inflated, or but there's a potential inflation with regard to the rates as well. As part of our processes of the AG, we also use infrastructure specialists. Now, we've got a resource that we use with a PhD, so he's got a doctorate in engineering services, and his average charge-out rate is approximately 1,500. We benchmarked it with the DPSA rates and also the public works rates, and they also average around 1,400 to 1,500 an hour. However, the resources for Company A claimed approximately 3,500 rand per hour. So you've got an inflation with regard, a potential inflation with regard to the actual hours worked by the resource, as well as the hours worked by, the rate claimed by the resource. So if you then conflate it, it begs the question with regard to value for money and whether there's potential fruitless and wasteful expenditure, and hence also the qualification in our audit report on the completeness of fruitless and wasteful expenditure. And then, can I hand over to my colleagues with regard to the performance bonuses? I don't think our audit work has revealed any payment of performance bonuses in terms of our HR management. We really focused a lot on the supply chain management in terms of the risk within the environment. I'm going to hand over now to Mr. Stephen Khalay, who will just deal with the funding model question quickly. Honorable Chair.
All right, thank you, Honorable Chairs and Honorable Members. I think the funding model around water trading entity is the augmentation, and the augmentation is mainly for the new infrastructure development that they would have had, and that one it goes through normal appropriation. It's included in the E&E for the department, and then also the other portion is funded through the tariff that they actually receive. And I think in particular what went wrong here, if you look at, for example, around why they ended up in the red or within the going concern challenge, was one, they were when they were approving their budget, they actually included as part of money that they would recover long outstanding debt from the municipalities. Okay. So they included that they would spend about 2.9 billion recovered from long outstanding receivables. However, what they did not do was they did not put in place processes to actually now recover that money. That was the first flaw that they did not do. Secondly, as you spend, you ought to be monitoring whether is your collection going as you had planned, because then you have committed those collections. You need to be identifying or monitoring that to see whether you are collecting as you had done, and that monitoring also did not happen. So the monitoring was not there to highlight to themselves early enough to say, but we're spending money that we have not that we had anticipated to receive, but we had not received. I think that was the second flaw around that, and the third flaw was the fact that they had other projects that they spent on which they had not budgeted for. Yeah. So there were other significant, the casing point becomes the SEP procurement that happened. So the SEP procurement, although the submissions went to the DG, you would see that already their budget was committed, and after the budget was fully committed, so all that you expect to recover, you have fully committed, and then you have lined up expenditure against that money, right? Then comes this SEP that you want to procure, then you obviously have to let loose some of the expenditures that you would have committed, because you can't increase your revenue or reserves collections. So you had to reduce some of the expenditures. So our question was, which ones specifically are you letting go in order to bring on board the SEP procurement? And that analysis was not done. So our conclusion, therefore, was that even though you are saying you're going to make budget, where you're not demonstrating where you're going to make budget available to fund this SEP. So SEP is an example of those. We have included in our slides projects which we came into which were not budgeted. We have included that in slide 44. So we have listed all those items where there was no budget. So I think around the financial strain that sits within water trading entity is that specific thing, those specific things that we mentioned.
Right. Okay. In
concluding what my colleague has said, Honorable Chair, that comment on slide number 44 should be read in conjunction with slide number 50. Because on slide number 50, we also highlight to the members the consequential impact of these budget constraints now. So you'll see the department has submitted a revised APP now where they've significantly reduced some of the service delivery targets. So the number of projects which were budgeted for example, on 2.3.7 on slide number 50, they had a target of 26 projects. Now the target has been reduced to 16. Some of them significantly so, from 55 on ACIP projects now to one project. So this is a direct result of now the physical strain that was put on the current year resources, where you plan to do certain projects, but now you must make use of that money to now first address some of the money that you've already committed in terms of the overspending in the previous financial year.
All right. Okay. Ross, I do want us to move beyond this one. But let me allow you.
Sorry, Chair, am I getting carried away here? Because I like this topic about the municipalities and defaulting municipalities, but certainly that has a huge impact on the funding models of these entities. But my question to you is, with regards to the impairments, it's actually an impairment where the budget is not fully funded. And I just wanted to know, whose responsibility is it to see that the budget that is accepted is actually fully funded? It happens in the municipalities also, where they can't collect, and they know they will not collect. In terms of the tariffs, it will not be paid to the water entities. But where do we, and how can we assist to see that the budget is more realistic?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, from our point of view, when it comes to those planning matters and the sufficiency of the budget, we think that the accounting officer, when they engage in their in-year monitoring engagements with portfolio committees, should be picking that task up. I think that's where it belongs, Chair. Because the people in the portfolio committee, having approved many things in the different budget cycles, will be best placed to know what is sufficient and what may not be sufficient, in line with the spirit of being the key oversight over the activities of the department. So I think that's where that we will come from, Chair. As far as the question that Honorable Kono raised on deviations, I think it will be best to leave it in the hands of National Treasury. Maybe they'll go into more depth on that one, because they are principally the custodians of that mechanism.
Okay. Thank you very much, AG. I hope that comrades would have isolated a few thematic areas, because that was the objective of the presentation. Ministerial directives, issue of projects, stability of leadership, irregular expenditure with your deviations, expansions, accruals. Yeah, I think those are things that I've lifted out. Thanks very much, Gigi. Can we hand over to National Treasury to talk to us. Ready when you are ready.
The laptop that we had doesn't have a cable for the, or doesn't have a port for it. Honourable members, honourable chairperson, thank you. My name is Ulrika Britton. I am the chief director in a unit in the public finance division called Urban Development and Infrastructure. I am with my colleague, Mr. Solich Tangano, who is from the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer. We have been asked very specific questions around dealing with the budgeting matters in the department and the water trading entity, and then also around deviations and expansions. So we will be doing two separate presentations. The first is specifically on the budgeting and the budgeting matters within the department. We'll go back up to about 5 years looking at that. We would look at some of the budget risks that popped up in the annual report, and what does that mean going forward, and then I've spent some time looking at where we are for this financial year. We would do something similar with the water trading entity. We will ask a very specific question around the overdraft in the water trading entity and the progress in the agreement between the Department of Water and Sanitation and the National Treasury on this. So in relation to the department, so we have seen rapid growth in the budget of the Department of Water and Sanitation. So between 2013 and 2015-16, we had average annual growth of 20% from 8.9 billion to about 15 billion rand. Then we had some budget cuts, which moderated the growth in the department, and we still have growth. We still had some growth in the budget of the department, and over the 2018 MTEF, the budget is expected to grow to 17 billion rand in 2021 at an average annual rate of 3.7%. In relation to spending performance, the department has generally been a good spender of its budget. In 2012-13, the department spent 96% of its budget. In 2013-14, it spent 98.8% of its budget. In 2015-16, the department only spent 85% of its budget, and I'll talk about that a little later. In 2015-16, they spent 98.8% of the budget, and they had overspent in 2016-17, where the department spent 100.7% of the budget. So in 2014-15, a large share of what's happening in the budget is really on their capital budget and a very specific program where we have the capital grants, And in that specific program, the budget, they only spent 83%. So just thinking about how the department, the distribution of spending within the department, so given the project distribution, I mean, we'd expect large projects to be on a J-curve, so you'd see significant, you start to slow and a ramp up. But because this is a portfolio of projects, you'd expect it to be relatively stable because as projects come to an end, other projects start up. So project, because projects are in a different stage of the project cycle, you'd expect that to be relatively flat. But what we see in 2014-15 is the department spent 47% of its capital budget in the last month of the financial year. For the fourth quarter of that year, it was almost 60% of the budget. They spent 57% of the capital budget in the last 3 months of the year. That suggests something's not happening.
Can you just start again on that part? The 47%?
47%. In 2014-15, the department spent 47% of its capital budget in the last month of the financial year. That has improved over, that has improved in the last 3 years, where by 2016-17, that was only 14% of their capital budget. Despite that, 30% of their capital budget was still spent in the last quarter of the financial year. And so there is some kind of project cycle issues happening, money flowing when we shouldn't be expecting money to be flowing. In relation to goods and services, so this is largely the department's operational budget, we see similar kind of trends with significant spending like in the last quarter of the financial year. What one would expect with payments on goods and services, these are general operations, so these are paying for the leases that we have on printers, office accommodation, municipal service charges and all of that, so you'd also expect it to be relatively stable. What's slightly different with this department is that would make it a little bit more lumpy is payments that they have to consultants. So this department has a large consultant's budget that they use for infrastructure planning and all of that, and that might be lumpy depending on what happens to projects. But similarly, in 2015-16 and 2016-17, 20% of the goods and services budget was spent in the last month of the financial year. So in the last quarter of 2015-16, that was equivalent to 37% of the total goods and services budget. So where we really have a problem with what's happened in the department is the overspending that we've seen in 2016-17. As I said, the department spent 100.7% of their total budget. This is largely related to an overspending on the bucket eradication program in the water and sanitation services program. We have also seen some underspending on conditional grants on the water services infrastructure grant in the water infrastructure development program. And as a result of this, the department had overspent on the vote by 110.8 million. So what does this mean? So in terms of the PFMA, the definition for unauthorized expenditure is overspending on the vote or the main division of the vote. So we have an 110.8 million rand overspending on the vote and 292 million rand overspending on the main division of the vote because in the water and sanitation program. The Auditor General had already dealt with some issues around irregular expenditure and fruitless and wasteful expenditure. But there is some kind of risk in relation to expenditure management in the department. The 2016-17 annual report shows that they have accruals of about 1.5 billion rand. Of that, 550 million rand was older than 30 days. So what does this mean in relation to the unauthorized expenditure? Is had these invoices been paid within the 30 days that they should have been paid, the unauthorized expenditure would have increased by the 550 million rand. In relation to the invoices that they had on the accruals for invoices that they had received within the 30 days, one would expect that this money would then be paid in the first month of the next financial year. And when I get to 17-18, we can compare these numbers. So some issues that has been raised by the Auditor General in relation to what does this mean for the budget is really around how conditional grants are managed. Are we paying municipalities on time in accordance with the Division of Revenue Act? Are we getting the value out of municipalities and what the Division of Revenue Act requires municipalities to do, and is the department monitoring that adequately? And that's really a value for money kind of performance issue. So are we buying what we say we are buying?
The Auditor General's already dealt with all the internal control issues. What's quite interesting around the internal control is that in the 2016-17 annual report, the Auditor General says that the policies and procedures weren't properly implemented. In the 15-16 annual report, there weren't any policies and procedures. So while there has been some kind of progress made within the department, we don't know if this was just in compliance with the audit observation that was made, or if this was in generally trying to improve project management and program management within the department. There were issues on procurement that the Auditor General has already raised. Where the big budget risk lies is in thinking about the commitments that pop up in the annual report of the department. And the department shows that they have about 9.1 billion rands worth of commitments. Now, ordinarily, that shouldn't be a problem because the nature of a multi-year contract would mean that you would, that when your future appropriations come, before you decide on any new project, you first look at your commitments in determining on what you have available before you expand programs. So where the risk lies around this 9.7 billion rand is that if you don't have systems to adequately monitor what your commitments are over a multi-period, then you don't know what parts of your budget is already committed for the next financial year or over the MTEF period. One of the things that we aren't able to track is what the age analysis of these commitments are. So if you have a five-year project, what are those contractual commitments that you have in relation to all of that? And it's really difficult to do when the department doesn't have a proper system in place where they are able to track and reconcile what they have spent against those projects already. So in relation to where we are in the current financial year, we don't expect the department to overspend on its budget right now. So as at the end of February, the department still had about 2.5 billion rand of its adjusted appropriation budget available to spend. This is largely related to conditional grant payments that they haven't made. And I went onto the system this morning to check what the department still has available. I mean, the financial year ends this week, and there's still about just 880 million rand in the department's adjusted appropriation available to spend. So we don't anticipate to see that unauthorized expenditure that we have seen in 16-17. But there are the risks related to the accruals and the commitments in relation to where we go to going forward. So in thinking about how the department on a monthly basis manages its cash, so you would recall I had just spoken about the 990 million rands worth of invoices that were less than 30 days at the end of last financial year. One would expect that these invoices are paid in the first month of the new financial year. But based on the green line that we see there and the green spot that we for April, the department only spent 200 million rand in April. So while they had drawn down, so the anticipation was, there was some kind of anticipation that this money would have been spent because they drew down 1.3 billion rand and they told us they wanted to draw down 1.3 billion rand, yet they only spent 200 million rand with 900 million rand of invoices sitting from the previous year. So in thinking about compliance around paying invoices within 30 days, this does become a huge issue because then when did the department pay this? Because as expenditure is always been lagging on how the department draws down from the PMG account. In relation to the water trading entity, so the water trading entity is slightly complex, and the table on the screen shows the cash flow statement for the water trading entity for the last 5 years. So this is slightly different to the income statement because where the water trading entity would then want to account for some of the outstanding debt that municipalities pay them as revenue, what I'm only showing is what they've actually received in cash. So these are actual cash receipts and the actual cash payments that has flowed out, so it's slightly different. And what we see over the last 5 years is that the saline raw water has actually increased. So despite the water trading entity showing large outstanding debt from municipalities, the actual sales and the actual revenue that they've gotten in has increased significantly over the last 5 years. But what's also quite interesting is that expenditure, specifically operating expenditure within the water trading entity, has also significantly increased in the last 5 years. And we'll try and deal with some of that in the next slide. The reason why I highlight, and it's not quite clear on the screen, is the cash payments in 2015-16 is because this number is slightly different to what they have in their printed annual report, and I think that's just a printing error in their annual report. But the balances all add up. So what's quite interesting also is that if you look at the line that says transfers received, yes, we have reduced the transfers to the water trading entity, but we had warned them about this in previous years. So the significant reduction in 2016-17, the water trading entity was aware about, and we'd expected them to make adjustments within their program at the end of 2014-15 when we had issued the allocation letters. And that doesn't seem to have happened. What we also see is a significant jump in capital expenditure in 15-16 in the water trading entity. The payments that they make to the TCTA is quite consistent. So that's the line that says repayments of other financial liabilities. That's largely to the TCTA. So, I mean, as committee members are aware, the TCTA is a special purpose vehicle that is used to finance some of the infrastructure, at least the commercial component of the infrastructure within the water trading entity. And to honor the financial commitments that the TCTA has, the water trading entity makes payments to them. And this is kind of being relatively consistent at about 4 billion rand a year. So just going back to what's the significant growth in goods and services, it's largely operational expenditure. And when we looked at where this money was going to, it was going into professional services, into contractors. What we can also see quite interestingly is that the line that shows expenditure increasing at an average annual growth over that five-year period by 111% is also issuing instructions to the water trading entity, or growth in the proliferation of, or the proliferation of instructions to the water trading entity to execute functions that's not in their mandate. So specifically, the water trading entity is an institution that deals with water resource management. This is in the last 2 years that I show up here. What we're seeing is the water trading entity getting increasingly more involved in doing water services projects. So this is specifically projects like War and Leaks, which is a municipal function. These are municipal assets, and you're seeing the water trading entity spending more and more money going into those kinds of projects. So in relation to specifically to the overdraft that the water trading entity has on their primary banking account, which is with us, we've seen a rapid deterioration in the cash balances within the banking accounts of the water trading entity. And this coincides with that rapid increase that we are seeing in the operating expenditure. And as a result of that, it was this time last year where we had written to the department alerting them that we will not process any payments on this account until we have some kind of agreement on how the department will repay this. So at the time, there was about a 2.6 billion rand overdraft, and you can see that's on the last line towards the bottom on the 1st of April 2017. So we kind of estimated that there will be ending around the 2.6, 2.7 billion, and we have said if we're not able to reverse this, we will not process any payments on that. And for about 10 days, we didn't allow any payments to be processed through this account. And we had some kind of an agreement with the water trading entity that in the first year they would pay back 700 million rand, or they would reduce the overdraft by 700 million rand. And our projections are that they will meet that target. And the current agreement is that the balance of this will be reduced. We'll get this thing back into positive balance by the end of next financial year. So by 31 March 2019, we expect the water trading entity to be back into a positive balance on their PMG account. But with all of this comes some kind of risk. And we're not sure exactly why the water trading entity was able to do some of this, because so in December we again stopped when we saw that the water trading entity wanted to continue paying for some of these water services. We stopped the account again, and we didn't allow them to do some kind of banking on that. But one of the risks that poses to the water on the water trading entity, or the water trading entity poses to the fiscus, is really what the water trading entity pays to TCTA. And even though the financial statements of the water trading entity have consistently showed that they owe the TCTA about 3 billion rand every year, in the last audit report, the Auditor General basically said that they had underdisclosed what they owed the TCTA by about 1.5 billion rand. Now, if we're not able to make that payment to the $1.5 billion, if we're not able to make the that water trading entity isn't able to make the payments to the TCTA timely, it does pose a risk to the debt portfolio of the TCTA. And one of the issues around all of that is that whether the TCTA has sufficient money in its bond redemption fund to meet any of its bond commitments that may pop up in the next 12 to 18 months. Some of the other risks that pops up that probably put some kind of pressure on the fiscus, and I suppose the reason why the Department of Water and Sanitation likes to come to the budget is because the transaction costs are a lot lower. So it's a lot easier coming to the Treasury saying we need more money than it is going to the market and saying we're going to install some kind of discipline that would allow us to collect our revenue, or that we're going to install some discipline in how we finance or how we structure the financing of some of our projects. Some of the other risks that the Auditor General has already raised is whether we're getting value for money out of our projects. If we're saying that we're spending 100 million rand on a capital project, are we getting that back in assets? And they were saying that there isn't really a system to support this. I've already spoken about the risks to the TCTA, and then just really around controls to detect non-compliance with laws and regulations that really speaks around the fiscal discipline and whether both the department and the water trading entity is able to execute its responsibilities that are set out in the PSMA. Thank you, Chair. I'm going to stop right there.
Thank you. That was National Treasury.
That's the first half of it. There's the deviation.
Oh, yes. Okay. Sorry. We received a summary version of this big, I'm not sure whether you did or receive it from Madia, from the content advisor. Did you receive? Email. Where is the, Sharon, did you send it all to all? Okay, can you quickly get somebody to please stand?
Thanks. Just to, from the observations from the Office of the Procurement side, just to emphasize the what we called previously the match spike, where in certain departments you will only see that the first quarter, the second quarter, the third quarter, they're not spending. But in their last quarter, they release a lot of payments, which we called match spike. There's still some element if you were looking at the Department of Water and Sanitation. But from the procurement side, there were no deviations that were given to the department for the cases that were reported either by the Auditor General or some of the cases that I will refer to. They were just deviating on their own without the support from National Treasury. The deviations that we have given are deviations that they submitted later, but the procurement that led to their problems or cash flow problems starting to be noted in from January 2017 were procurements that they've done on their own or deviations that they will have approved on their own. One key project that is not mentioned in the Auditor General report is the appointment of a company called MSW. And it came to us because there were allegations that Lipelle Northern Waters
was about to pay 19 million for work not done. And when we engaged the Lepelele Northern Water, what we discovered is what is on the slide there. When you check the procurement plan, you'll see the initial budget was around 20 million. But when we engaged them to further to say, well, if your budget was only 20 million, and now in May 2017, the company has already done work worth more than 200 million. How come you allow a situation like that? From the slide, you'll see there were directives. Obviously, those letters during the inquiry were made available to you, because in May 2017, the department directed the entity, Lepelele Northern Water, to say, stop making any payments because they don't have cash. The letter was coming from the Director General of the department. That letter is there. You will be able to use it. And this is one of the projects. I think from the Lepelele Northern Water, during that time, there were three projects that we are aware of that were having serious cash flow problem. You'll find that there was a project from the Nandoni Dam to Gian, the pipeline. Also, it was experiencing the same cash flow problem. And then you'll have the LTE one, which obviously you are aware of. But when you check now the procurement, how the procurement was done, like the LTE, the department outsourced its responsibilities, for example, to the entity Lepelele Northern Water. Lepelele Northern Water only appointed one supplier, a consulting firm. Then a consulting firm is allowed to appoint construction companies. In other words, what is happening is that the department or the entity is outsourcing the responsibilities, procurement responsibilities. Now the problem comes when you are saying, but suppliers are not being empowered. Who's supposed to empower the suppliers? Is the department or a government entity? Because when you appoint a construction company and a subcontractor, that's where the department should be able to comply with the PPFA, in other words, the Preferential Procurement Regulations or Act. But in that case, they will not do that, because you outsource your responsibilities to a private company, and the private company will decide, and they are not going to apply those empowerment goals that are prescribed. You will see with the LTE, initially when I was looking at the budget that was provided in the 2015-16, there was a provision of 10 million of what they were supposed to do there. Around Gian. But the initial appointment is just below 100 million. But if you look at the annual performance plan submitted to for 2016-17, submitted to Parliament, now the commitment for the same project in Gian is around 2.2 billion. Now the question that you must ask is, if the provision was only 10 million initially, where is the other money going to come from? Exactly the same with the first project that I indicated, the Olifants and Ebenezer water scheme. You can see the trend. The trend is that the department will just commence with a project, and they will even commit where there's no budget. And the outcome of that commitment, you see now in May 2017, because the department is owing a lot of suppliers. Letters are issued to all these entities to stop the projects. And what we are not sure of is whether all those suppliers that were being owed in May 2017 whether the department has settled. Otherwise, the report that was given from the public finance side, during the inquiry, it should be the department should be able to clearly indicate whether all the suppliers that were owed, have they been paid? Because you may find that, obviously, that information is outside the books. You can't see it unless a supplier will come and complain and say, I'm still being owed this money. And some of the suppliers, like when we met with MSW, because we were asking, but the allegations are against you that you claimed 19 million and you haven't rendered any services. Then they produce a number of invoices to us. This is but you see, all these invoices, the work that we have done is more than 200 million. Therefore, the allegation that we have never rendered a service is not true. Those are the issues that obviously as the committee you will need to look at. But if you look at this trend and ask again, in August 2017, after they have experienced all these problems and the issuing of the letters stopping payment, the Department of Water and Sanitation through the minister came to finance. They wanted to commence with the Umzimvubu project. And that project, they did not have money. Obviously, they wanted guarantee also from finance. But they wanted to loan 20 billion. It's a department that has got cash flow problem. But they're still saying we need 20 billion. And you don't even know how are they going to service this loan because already they were experiencing problems. But they came to us. They wanted to deviate. If you read the deviation letter there, they even wanted to deviate from Section 217 of the Constitution. They wanted the Minister of Finance to allow them to do that because what they wanted was to appoint a supplier. If you and the supplier, in other words, it would be the same like the turnkey one in the Lipelena, because what they wanted, they were saying, we will appoint a supplier who is a bank. The bank will fund. In other words, the bank will give Water and Sanitation 20 billion. But the same bank is given the responsibility to appoint suppliers to supervise the project and to construct. In other words, the department is just receive 20 billion on paper because obviously that money will reside with the same bank because the bank will still have the responsibility to appoint a supplier. To supervise or to design, and again to construct. In other words, the department has outsourced its responsibilities. There will be no empowerment because obviously it was not a local bank that they were wanted to appoint. It was an international bank. But if you look at the trend in most of this project, it's either a turnkey project where one supplier is given all the responsibilities to design and to construct and to supervise the construction, which becomes a problem because immediately you outsource that responsibility. There are no segregation of duties. If the designs are poor, nobody will be able to see it because it's me. I've given you this design, I will construct, I will do whatever. But otherwise, in general, when you look at the cash flow problem that is there in the department, mainly is because, I don't know currently now, but there was no sound cash management in the department. And because of that, that's why we have so many problems. The presentation earlier indicated that if they were paying the suppliers that they were owing, the department will have unauthorized expenditure for the past 2 to 3 years. Otherwise, if they were paying all the suppliers, if you look at the accruals, what they were doing was just to postpone the problem and postpone, but until they couldn't handle that. And that it's what I'm saying we noted as National Treasure, even in other provinces or that would have gone under Section 100. What happens is that they postpone payments until they couldn't do it, then national government will put them under Section 100. But otherwise, in brief, we have given you deviations, but those deviations are not relevant to why the department find itself, because those requirements that were done, where they have done on their own.
Clearly, you are dealing with a very complex set of issues. And I can also say that there could be a few more examples that we can attest to. Insofar as all the transgressions are concerned.
Correct, we can still look at the, because most of the time from the OCPO side, when we receive an allegation, we will have done some work. We can still look at all those complaints we have received and engage the department. We can give you further reports on that.
Okay. Again, our task is to isolate the issues, package them as part of our brief as we engage in the inquiry. So whatever questions and comments, they are directed in that part. I saw a hand of Mam Kuno. That's all.
Thank you, Chairperson. You know, we as SCOPA, we're fed as a committee. We want to help departments not to drown further as part of guiding the fiscus of the council. And thank you for the presentation from Treasury. But I want to say to Treasury today, you know, the presentation that, especially that Sol is making, you know, I was waiting for that summary. Maybe your summary could have done better. But the thick document that we have in front of us and what we have been reading from the documents we got from Ben Gunn, it's contrary to what Soli is saying. Soli has approved all these deviations that he's talking about. He understands that this is a problem here and there, but he has approved those deviations. Can I make examples here? I know that this is not an inquiry that like that, but I just want to understand. Maybe it's because it's the first time that you deal with this type of inquiry. I'll make an example. To Mr. Lohodi, request to deviate from normal procurement procedures and appoint a lady trading and WIER, Hakitsuki Zero or Wire, minerals for support and maintenance services. The National Treasury has acknowledged receipt of your letter. The letter requests deviation, blah, 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 blah. And the fifth, which is his approval, the reason for deviation is unjustifiable. And it goes on and on. This one is for the wire minerals. I also have the request to deviate from normal procurement procedures and appoint a state-owned enterprise review publication for placement of an article through single sourcing. It has been approved. It's just, I don't want to go through all of the deviations that Soli has approved. But all I'm trying to say, you know, when I was listening to your presentation, I forgot your name. Ulrike. I was actually starting to have hope that it is Treasury is taking us somewhere. You understand these things. You don't help a particular entity or a department to drown further, but actually guide them to say this is the way to go. The Treasury regulations are quite clear. As you understand, and Soli has put it clear, that you look into their budget, the pros and cons, what is the problem with this budget and how can we help you. But yet, you go on single sourcing deviations to make sure that money is channeled to a particular, companies, instead of making sure that the procurement process is as clear and it's open to all, not to particular companies. It's a serious problem, and I don't think you are hearing us. I don't think you are hearing us. You can't talk about something else, and you go on paper and approve something different. So I don't understand. Maybe Kilashekile Chairperson, I really need to have your guidance. But it would be proper if you take us serious and you prepare. Because, you know, when you presented, I was asking myself at first, do you meet with Soli together and prepare, and did you prepare for this meeting? And when Soli came and actually agreed on what you have said, but has signed something else in paper, in practice, then it really gets frustrating, and I'm really frustrated, Chairperson. I really need your help. Thanks.
Any further questions? Mrs. Chiron?
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to ask on the Mzimvubu, then, am I correct? Yes. On this application for the department to be exempted, which the department declined the application, but on the lending of money, is the same money that we're talking about that they got the overdraft from the Reserve Bank, or is a separate one, this one? Just that clarity, Chair.
Mrs. Mende?
Thanks, Chair. Chair, on the deviations that Soli says the department did on their own, when the department was then reporting to the procurement office, what did the procurement office do? Did they actually, at a later stage, furnish your office with letters of the reasons and all that? And did someone sign from the procurement office? And then secondly, a writer on what Shilwane has asked in terms of the overdraft. How did they get to do the overdraft without Treasury? Because there are processes. So how did they successfully do it without consulting with Treasury?
And perhaps, though we are expecting a feedback from the department tomorrow, among others, on this very overdraft that we're making mention of. We have asked them to give us in writing a copy in black and white of that agreement on that overdraft that they took. Well, there have been conflicting statements whether this is from Reserve Bank or from National Treasury. As far as we understand, perhaps you might also wish to assist us in that regard. Where is that overdraft seated? Okay, any further questions, clarities, comments? Mr. Ross?
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to add my voice to the concerns of my colleagues, when you do these massive, massive projects in terms of water supply, and it's huge projects, and it's not procurement of just goods and services, it is... It runs into the billions of rand. Certainly in the founding stages of discussions and in the planning stages, there needs to be some consultation with Treasury. And I cannot can excuse the fact that this is an emergency situation. When you start building a dam that
is a project of 5 years or 10 years to be completed. It is massive projects. And then, to note that it's impractical to invite competitive bids, it certainly doesn't wash with this committee. I don't think we can condone it. And I think my colleagues have alluded to some practicalities in this regard. But never can we be misled to say this is an emergency situation when you have a long-term project to be concluded. And certainly I think if we can have a thorough analysis of the cost increases and how the fiscus was actually put strained upon in terms of this lack of planning and the lack of perhaps action from the procurement offices in Treasury being the oversight, where we actually bank on Treasury to play an oversight role, a very strong oversight role. And I think we've been working very hard to strengthen the Treasury regulations, to narrow it down, to see that we work towards an exceptional, that deviations and extensions are complete exceptions, and that the normal norm that we use is an open competitive bidding process. I cannot think that this committee can condone these actions, Chairperson. It is definitely not emergency situations. And it's definitely not a situation where immediate action is required. And then we would like to, I think we also need to investigate the role of the procurement officer, in which should play an oversight role and which should actually be a deterrent in terms of misspending and inflating projects to the extent that is a huge strain and a huge risk to the fiscus of this country.
Okay, Mrs. Kono, and then the chair.
Yes, thanks. Just to add, Chairperson, what the I forgot her name again. She said that as she was reporting that most of the budget will be used the last term of the financial year, which is the problem that you find in most departments. That's why non-planning, it becomes a key problem within government, because then that non-payment actually says that if you have procured with Water Affairs as that day, just before your contract has expired and everybody knows that it has to come to an end, then that's when they ask for deviations and actually put a gun and say, if you don't put this one, then it means processes will stop within the department. That's why we have a problem with deviation. It's nothing except for non-planning and actually helping your buddies to get projects more and more and more. And that's why we have a problem when you find a key department like National Treasury colluding or agreeing with this non-planning. It actually says to all the Treasury regulations and what we are all trying to achieve as this government and as public representatives, it's not considered at all, because they are supposed to be helping and actually saying this is the way to go. And they understand that. That's why the presentations that they've made here today actually says we do understand that. We understand the dynamics. We understand the problems that are in the department. But after understanding them, then they go on condoning wrong things. So that's why I'm just emphasizing on the point that I've said earlier on, that really these deviations, we have to find a way of dealing with them in a better way. And it will take out the problem that she has talked about, that the departments actually spend towards the end of the financial year, because that's where you find all these problems. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, Chair.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a request on Mr. Chitangano, because he indicated at the beginning that the deviations that actually led to the financial strains in the department were done without consulting National Treasury. If you could maybe just send us, even if it's a one pager, that says these are the contracts and these are the amounts that were incurred in each one of them. These are the ones that were done without the approval or requesting the approval of National Treasure, because we're where we are today because of that, meaning that if that was not done, we may not be sitting here, actually. So that is the, for me, that is the number of the totality of the problem, over and above all the other issues that have been raised. So if you could do that for us, I think it would assist in guiding the discussions later on.
I take it that our content advisors are on the alert, as they are expected to assist us in lifting up some of the issues as we package out of this submission. I must also mention, members, especially from SCOPA, that as a department we had also begun a process which we are expecting a written feedback tomorrow. A process that looks into the human resource part of the department, and especially on the capacity side of things. We have been requesting since last year a copy, or rather a submission on the organogram. What shocked us at the most, apart from 5 programs and almost 9 divisions, in other words, with your DDGs, apart from those 9 DDGs, as if it's not enough, we also got to hear of 2 floating DDGs. And we also got to know of 3 CFOs. One of those CFOs has a BTEC, and some of those DDGs, they have grade 12. Now, this talks to the issue you are talking about related to the capacity and planning. It's quite a serious issue, I must say. So that we also get a sense of what we are dealing with. It's not anything that we, of course, the National Treasury, it does come close to that, and members are able to lift some of those issues quite succinctly. So these are the issues that are not starting now, and of course also they also form part of our main concern as a committee dealing with water and sanitation, as we have been dealing with the department for quite some time. Okay, those are a few. If you have any specific issues to raise, respond rather.
Thank you, Chair. Let's start with the easy ones. So in relation to Honorable Shawani's question on Mzimvubu, so no, this is separate. The overdraft of the water trading entity has nothing to do with any of the financing arrangements around Mzimvubu Water, the Mzimvubu Water Project. The financing arrangements for Mzimvubu Water Project was the Minister of Water and Sanitation had given a directive to the TCTA to implement. What that would then mean is that the TCTA would have to go into the market. One of the issues around the financing of the Mzimvubu Water Project is that this is a social project. There is no revenue streams that will pay back the loan. And when you have that, what it really means is this is a project. When you do a project of that nature, it should really be funded on the budget. In relation to Honorable Ross's question about water supply and how the department consults with us on these things. So in relation to the budgeting of these projects, for at least the large projects, what would happen is we would have a conversation or a series of conversations throughout the budgeting process with the department around all of this. You will recall that we had also introduced the budget facility for infrastructure in the last budget, so my colleagues are currently reporting on this in the Committee on Appropriations, where any projects that are funded that need to be funded on budget need to go through an evaluation and an appraisal process. So we've had a series of those projects, I think it was around 68 projects, the last chunk of those projects were water projects that came through that facility. And so these are ongoing conversations, but this is really around the financing and the implementation readiness of these projects, where my job stops and Solly's job starts is really around the procurement. So we would get involved with like a project like the Mzimbubu Water Project in the planning and the financing of those projects. Once it goes through the procurement phases, I mean, we don't get involved in that, and then we again get involved with it while spending starts, because then we want to monitor spending against what those projections are that they had in all of that. In relation to budget planning, I mean, so one of the big concerns that we've always had around budget planning and program planning within the departments is how do we align all of that. There is a planning unit within the Department of Water and Sanitation, and what has emerged to us, at least in the last budget preparation cycle, is there doesn't seem to be, or there's very little relation between what's happening in the budget planning unit with the project planning unit in the department on water services versus what is happening in the projects that are actually being implemented. And this was an emphasis of matter from the Auditor General, is that when decisions are taken in one unit that impacts on another unit in the department, they don't necessarily consider that before the decision is taken. So the planning unit will say that according to our planning cycle, these are the projects that are due to be done, but in another unit, in the implementation unit, they disregard all of that and they do their own series of projects. So that does seem to be quite prevalent. We've always wanted to strengthen, and I mean, so what you'll see in the 2018 budget is shifts within the budget to strengthen the planning unit and elevate the planning unit within the department so that we can get better alignment between what is being planned and what is currently being spent. I think I'm going to stop there.
Okay, thanks. Then we will provide you a list with a list of all the deviations that were approved by the department. Just to give you one example, with Giani Water Project, there was an element of emergency in the beginning, because there was no water at the hospital. Obviously, it was just one lack. But what the department, in this case, Water and Sanitation, did was to see that there's this emergency. Instead of saying, let's deal with the emergency, the deviation, which I will also give you the letter, Lipele is appointing LTE, they use emergency, and in terms of 16864, they don't need to come to us if there's an emergency. They have to do it on their own, and from there, the responsibilities is to report to us and to AG within 10 days after they have deviated. That is the obligation that they have. But there's no way where I would say reverse that decision, because is the accounting officer's responsibility to do that, or the accounting authority. They reported to AG, that's why AG reported. And still, after they deviated and reported, AG still said this is irregular, because obviously they were taking advantage of a small emergency. The pipe is burst. You need to fix the pipe. But then you say, no, I'm appointing solely to fix the pipe, but do all other issues that are there. And that's what happened with LTE. And in most of the cases, there will be an element of emergency, which obviously you need to deal with it. But they take, obviously it's an abuse of the system now. They abuse the system to deal. But obviously when we deal with the issue of deviations, we, like AG indicated, there are areas where you don't have an option.
especially in areas where maybe when we have further discussions, use areas of systems. If you buy Microsoft products, you need annual licenses. There's no way you're going to advertise the company paid. They will have to come to us and say, we need to renew the license. You have cases like WhatsApp who are dominating, for example, in other entities and public entities. You procure that system. During the warranty period, nobody can come and maintain that system. They will say, we need to maintain. But if you are going to remove that deviation element, obviously, because it's there, it's an element of abuse. But I'm saying we need to look at how do we ensure that abuse is not there. Because obviously the speed limit is there is 120. But when I go above that, then it becomes a problem. But those are the issues that are there. The legislation makes provision. But as individuals, we abuse. And therefore, those who abuse must be dealt with. And if they are dealt with, obviously, you'll find that people will stop abusing the system. But we'll provide all the deviations that the department came to us after they've deviated reporting.
Okay.
No, Chairperson. Chairperson, well, I'll just comment on
this. This being our last round, and immediately go straight to SIU. Where is Arukin Schenken? Oh, yeah. Okay. Are you ready for any update?
Chair, on the opinion we... Chair, I can give the comment again. I can read the rule for the committee, but if you want me to present a written opinion after consultation with my colleagues, that's going to take a few days, Chairperson. It's... I'm not trying to be strange about it.
That's fine.
Let's
go through Mr. Ross, and then we shall have to come and take our own decision.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm just concerned with regards to the explanation from Solly in terms of the emergency situation of the hospital not having water. Certainly, if you strategically think correctly, you would say this is an emergency, the hospital must get water, but there's a short-term solution to this, fixing the pipes and all that. But the longer term, in terms of a contract of millions and billions of rand, that's another issue. So I don't find the explanation acceptable to say that the hospital doesn't have water and now we engage in multi-billion rand contracts based on the deviation concept. It's certainly not correct. There's a short-term solution to certain problems, and then there's a longer-term planning, etc. And I was very impressed with Treasury, with Ulrika's explanation and explaining to us how the organigram worked within Treasury, and that inspired some confidence to me. But I think in the procurement process itself then, in terms of the deviation, that's where we should then zoom in and look why it was given and how it was. Because the planning, certainly if there's a planning department in that engages with the department, and then you say your obligation stops when it becomes to the procurement, and later in the actual spending you're also involved. And I think we can do then, based on those information, it will empower us as a committee to do a much more thorough analysis of exactly what happened in each of these contracts. Thank you.
Mrs. Mente, noted, Mr. Nguni.
Chair, on the Giani projects, there's the boreholes of the Rolls Royce. And as the procurement office, you're the one that's sitting with prices and all everything and the fairness in terms of the values. So did you get to a point of evaluating a borehole for 2.5 million, if it's worth 2.5 million, one borehole from the procurement office? And secondly, the criminal element of abusing the power. Because if you are saying, like Ross is saying, if you are saying Giani started with the hospital as an emergency, and then they decided on their own to ride on the wave of the emergency and do everything else, that's criminal. You are stealing money. because they know for a fact everything else is something that they can do later. There's a process to follow before you reach there. Now you decide to do it without the appropriate body authorizing you. So did you deal with the criminal element of stealing money from the procurement office?
Okay, thanks. Chair, maybe just...
Mr. Nkwinti. Ah, Mr. I'm greeting Mr. Nkwinti.
Maybe I'll be the minister soon. I'm waiting for that.
I'm waiting a message from... Sorry.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. You know, I'm not convinced by the response from Mr. Sodi. Sodi, come out, man. Come out and tell us what really happened. You can't come here because you know the legislation. You yourself are saying a maximum time for emergency is 3 months. That's what you told us here. You see? And you are saying in 10 days after they have asked for this emergency or deviation, they must write to you of a pipe that has burst in the hospital. Almost a year later, the money escalated to what we have today. You are still quiet. And these people are still writing to you. Where is your money? Where are you? Where's your monitoring? You can't come here and tell us, no, I did not know they were hiding behind emergency. So you're not seeing what was happening around you. Because they were getting this from you. Oh, I'm so good, man. Oh, since I'm in Puma, I don't want to say, man, we are at it, man. It's made up on a law.
Okay, let's understand this to be saying we are going to be governed by rules. And our constitution, which enjoins us in our oversight responsibility, and the related legislation pieces. As we conduct this entire exercise, which we are about to. So part of those rules, Mr. Mguni is making mentioning of what is entailed in what's referred to as an emergency. So you did take us through the other day, and mentioning 3 months. Now these are straightforward rules and straightforward matters related to our constitution and also pieces of legislation that are relevant to what we are about. So as we move forward, we are going to be guided by those. You want to respond very briefly?
Obviously I was not regarding this as the start or the beginning of the inquiry. If you want... obviously, after we received the allegations, we didn't just sit. We did a review of how the procurement was done, and we have information. But I was just clarifying. If you want us to give you information to say what our findings were when we were doing the engagement, we will be able to tell you because, which is the information which I didn't want. Before the company was appointed, I'm saying some of the things that we found. Before the company was appointed, there was a delegation of the department and Lipele to the project site. And on that day of the inspection of the project, the supply was already there. But those are the things that during the inquiry you will need to ask to see. But as the department and Lipele, when you were visiting the site on your own, why was the supply there? Even before the deviation and other things were approved. But obviously, though, that information is there. We will be able to give you as the committee. We'll empower you as the committee to be able. If you were saying, okay, take us through, like we visited some of those boreholes, and some of them at that time when we arrived there was no work done, and we have those reports. I don't know whether you wanted me to say from your review can give us the report, because I was only clarifying. When I was saying they appointed on their own, I was not saying they were right, because that's why it's irregular expenditure. they abused the system, riding on emergency to do what was wrong. And even after we have received that report, we engaged, even with the SIU, I don't know what they will give, but during the investigation by the SIU, they also engaged us. Not even on this one, even on the one that is talked about, you'll find that we will have assisted the SIU, we will have given our affidavit of non-compliance with SEM so that the SIU should be able to proceed. That information is available if you want us to give. But I was just only giving you, because some of the information, for example, even when I met with the supplier, we asked the supplier, have you visited the project before you were appointed? They said yes.
Okay, clearly we are starting a process. A number of things having been raised here are typically going to be work in progress. We shall have to, at the end, request our content advisors to assist us packaging a number of issues raised. Clearly, we have a responsibility equally to add if needs be, so that we begin to say to ourselves, yes, indeed, we are now in unison insofar as the issues that we want to probe are concerned. Okay, let us thank National Treasury. We are literally 30 minutes before SIU, or rather before we break for lunch, unless Is it one? That's what I'm saying when I say we break for lunch because of these other responsibilities. Whatever we do, let's have that as the back of our mind. Here, less than a minute. Mrs. Kuno, Mrs. Ndem.
Less than a minute. I just want to find out from, so that when we, as part of our homework, when we go back home, in your organogram, because we've never had the chance to look at your organogram as the procurement office, you know, how many are you? So that we, maybe we're blaming the wrong person. He has all these kind of responsibilities, and it's not only SIU that is doing, what is it? Not SIU, sorry, that it's not only WaterFirst that has a problem of deviations, it's all other departments. So I just want to know your breakdown, your organogram, how many are you? And the, what you have asked about, the information that he's giving us, we need to have the full information on the Rolls Royce. And, you know, like we have asked before, Chairperson, if you are going to approve something, you need to have a background of on all the prices. So that's why I want to know the what is it, the organogram, and what is the how are they supervising projects so that whatever that they have approved in their procurement.
That's process, over a minute now.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Mrs. Devin?
Small Chair, on your investigation, procurement office, in particular Water and Sanitation Department, did you at any point take anyone to law enforcement for criminal cases of stealing? Because if prices are inflated, where money is spent without value, then that's stealing. Was there at any point that happened?
On the members, we have the right, again, to go to any police station, informed by whoever who has more evidence, and open a case. Now, these processes, these legal processes, or rather, these law enforcement processes, they go parallel. We don't have to stop and then go. We might wish to get the National Treasury to give us an idea, but equally we have ourselves a responsibility. Where there are transgressions,
there is a police station not far from here. We go there. Exactly. Okay, you want to say your last concluding words
on
very briefly?
Correct. On all the other reports that we, for example, we review and finalize, whether it's forensic audit, we finally give them to the police in terms of Section 34 of the Prevention and Combating for them to do further criminal investigation. But for the Lepelle one, before we could even finish the review, already SIU had a proclamation to investigate the criminal element. That's why we are only working with them. We did not open a separate case.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for that. And once again, thanks for all the contributions from the members. Without waste of time, we have just consulted with the co-chair with regard to SIU. Having heard the discussion and also listening to the, you know, advocate or Leonard's friend out there, and the brief discussion that we had earlier on, we have a view that says, let us go and meet with, or rather, let us meet with the SIU in camera and source as much as we can out of that whole process. Otherwise, if we debate here, we can take forever. Clearly, Mr. Jenkins has commented. He was citing some of the legal documents and the rules. But at the end, the onus is on us as to what is it that we want to do best. So that's what we have as a view from the chair, that we meet in camera. We have submitted an application, I must say. However, the decision would have been that of a committee. We've heard that discussion earlier. And then having been looking at all the issues from all angles, that's what we have as a view. Are we fine with that? Mr. Kagan?
No, Chair, I think I fully support what you have just said, because we don't want a compromised process. And if we are going to meet with SIU, because initially we delegated you to do that. We didn't want to discuss those issues in public here, because they would compromise, that is, the entire process. Therefore, I fully support what you have just said.
Thanks for that. In fact, we did do what we were expected to do. But the advice equally was that the matter must be tabled for the consent of the committee, which is what we did. We did exactly what we were expected to, including that of the advice from the presidium. Without waste of time, members, I think we should thank once again the Office of the AG, National Treasury. We must now decide as to who remains. Obviously, the first culprits are your media, who must not be with us. And the second culprit shall be your cameras, which must be informed that we are now getting into an in-camera session. And then we take it from there.